The Laura Murphy Show, episode 66.
Welcome to The Laura Murphy Show, the podcast that analyzes financial markets from the perspective of Austrian economics and Nelson Nash's infinite banking concept. Listen and learn as your hosts, Robert Murphy and Carlos Lara, explain how you can be part of building the 10%.
Welcome, everybody. With a lot of popular demand, I've run into people, and they're like, hey, when are you guys releasing your next podcast? Well, we're doing it right now. You are listening to the next episode right now as we speak. So excuse the hiatus, folks. It's largely my fault just with the travel, but we are back in the saddle here. I am joined, as always, by Carlos Lara. Carlos, how are things up there in Nashville?
I'm doing really good, Bob.
Now, did you guys get hit with snow?
Actually, no. Now, the last time we had a podcast, you had really gotten hit with snow in Texas. But
Well, last night, earlier in the day, it was in the 50, high 50s. I almost didn't take a fleece out, and I finally did. And then I was going back to my car at night, and it was literally snowing. It was weird.
Oh, in other words, you got snow again.
Yeah, it melted. But yeah, and I heard in Chicago got dumped on and people up. So anyway, all right. Well, I guess you avoided both extremes then, safe and snug in the middle of the country.
We got rain. We just got rain, okay. Lots of rain.
All right, fair enough. Well, what we're talking about today, folks, in this podcast, it's the common theme is we're just going to talk about the Federal Reserve chairs, past and present. So one thing, I won't take too much time on this because it has to do with energy policy and not so much financial markets, but people may be aware that in the Wall Street Journal, I don't know if this was on your radar, Carlos, but the Wall Street Journal ran a letter that was signed by 45 economists, including, I don't remember the number off the top of my head, but it was more than a dozen Nobel Prize winners and like all living Federal Reserve chairs, obviously past and present, signed the letter. Some heads of the Council of Economic Advisors. It was big heavy hitters, and they were all calling for a carbon tax. And so I don't know what – it's just weird to me, that doesn't just happen spontaneously. It's not like they were all over at Janet Yellen's house having a party, and then someone started circulating this letter that they signed. So that's interesting. So for those listeners who are curious, I did critique it, as you can imagine, if you're familiar with my work. So I'll go ahead and link to that at the show notes page. Again, this is episode 66. But I don't know. Was that on your radar, Carl? Did you realize all these economists got together?
I had no idea.
Well, yeah. Well, they did. They're looking out for the planet, apparently. But anyway, that was interesting to me. And what's really funny about it is the progressive leftists have actually abandoned the idea of a carbon tax because they just say it's politically toxic. And also some of them are saying, oh, that's not going to be enough. Like, don't listen to these technocratic economists who are saying, just put a price on carbon in the market. The magic of the market will take over. No, we still need to have these stringent regulations to raise automobile fuel economy standards, get more miles per gallon. We got to just outright ban coal-fired power plants and they have all these things. So it's just interesting how the whole debate has shifted to, instead of saying, hey, do we need to do something about climate change now? All the serious people are, and that I'm probably answering my own question. This is probably part of what happened in terms of trying to shift, they call it the Overton window or whatever, that to say, oh, now the choice is between, do you just need a huge new carbon tax or do you need a huge new carbon tax plus all these other regulations? Like they're trying to move the needle on what's the allowable discussion for among the public. Hmm. So anyway, there you go. That's all the Fed chiefs got together on that. But obviously in this podcast, folks, this episode, we're going to focus more on Federal Reserve policy per se and its effects on the financial markets. So maybe, Carlos, the logical kicking off point is, do you want to maybe summarize some of what you were doing in the forthcoming Laura Murphy Report article that you've got?
Well, sure. The main thrust of the article was that we are definitely in a slowdown in the economy, it's not just here in the United States. It's also in Europe and in China as well. But it just seems that throughout 2019, you know, we're getting all these great reports coming in about how well the economy was doing. Of course, everybody knows that beginning in October of 2018, and then November, and then again in December, the stock market really, you know, went into a tailspin and ended the whole year very, very badly, having the worst, you know, December all the way back to the December during the Great Depression. So the stock market did not end well for the year 2018. The more I thought about the slowdown, the more I started looking into other areas and was trying to pinpoint where exactly are we seeing some major differences in the economy and trying to associate that with downturns. And obviously, one of the first things that caught my attention is just how many of the retailers are having financial trouble. I mean, really struggling. Some of the better names like Macy's and JCPenney and even, you know, the famous Texas retailer Neiman Marcus is struggling and, you know, trying to negotiate with creditors right now. They've got a lot of debt that's coming due, and in the next couple of years, and they're trying to keep from having to file their own bankruptcy petition. So,
and just to stop you for a second, Carlos, just for the listeners who may not be aware, you had a lot of personal experience in the retail industry growing up, right? Like when you were making your bones.
I did. In fact, you know, when I was in college, I actually worked for Neiman Marcus, which is probably one of the most prestigious retailers in the world. Actually, there were only three stores at that time, and when I was in college, my mentor there was, you know, Stanley Marcus Jr. himself. And so it was a great operation to be associated with.
Can I ask you, I mean, this is totally, you weren't expecting me to take it this way, but now that I'm talking to you, what do you mean he was a mentor? Like he told you when someone walks in the store, this is how you line them up for get them into a suit and that kind of stuff?
No. Not necessarily in that sense, but they had, he had developed what he called some sort of like an executive training program for the future leaders of the company. And you got to remember, this is before computers, Bob. And so he had the special formula that he would teach all of his buyers and managers, and it was called an open to buy. And so the open to buy was a way to project out the kind of revenue that you would be having in the upcoming year and be able to do the calculation to know exactly how much you had available to purchase in order to make those sales happen. And so it was a very nifty little formula that I learned, and so some of the other fellows that were in the class with me. And actually, it was the beginnings for me when I first went into the consulting business and started working with other retailers that were struggling with inventories. I used that formula repeatedly to try to help other retailers, you know, deal with their out-of-control inventories that were causing so much trouble during the period that was also going through a lot of contractions, in that arena. So, yeah, it wasn't so much you know, actually selling the merchandise, but more or less, you know, planning and projecting for the purchases of inventories, which is, you know, in the retail business, that's your number one item. That's the lifeblood, so to speak, of the retail business. But more along what we're talking about here, what we're seeing is that there's been declining sales at retail stores for numerous reasons. Of course, a lot more people now are shopping online. And a lot of these big names, big retailing names that you find all over the country in shopping centers, they're losing revenue. For that reason, you got the big box stores and Amazon now coming in with a lot of competition. And so, you know, a lot of these brick and mortar operations are being left empty all over the United States. You know, you see more and more of that going on. And And then with the declining sales, you're seeing a lot of them having to, you know, just go ahead and file for bankruptcy. You know, I'm sure everybody knows by now that Sears, that used to be one of the bigger names in the retail business, very old establishment, you know, actually filed for Chapter 11 in the latter part of last year, and is now still trying to negotiate, see if they can keep themselves alive, see if they can get somebody to come in and bail them out. But anyway, we're seeing that in that arena, and a big shift going on there. And then, of course, when I started looking into the car industry, Bob, I saw the same kind of downward slide occurring. You know, in the fact that car sales have been down probably for about three straight years now. Mm-hmm. And so we're seeing a slowdown there. General Motors announced a big shutdown on several plants, and they're going to cut back on their sales force. You know, Ford's the only company in the United States, car company in the United States, that hadn't filed for bankruptcy yet. So, you know, that industry is, you're definitely seeing it there. And China is having a big slowdown with automobiles as well. So you start looking around and you start seeing that things are not as, on the economic front, it's not as happy as advertised by so many of the mainstream media. Of course, you and I have been saying that the economy really was anemic all along, and a lot of what we were seeing was being propped up by all kinds of, you know, financial engineering. The biggest problem being what the Federal Reserve did during the years, you know, coming out of the 2008 financial crisis that have caused so much of this. But real estate also is beginning to show the signs of a slowdown, both at the commercial level as well as the residential level, especially with mortgage rates now starting to climb up. There's things like that are easy to spot, and it's been interesting. You know, you're talking about the Federal Reserve chairman's that there's so much dependent on what these guys say. And, you know, it was like that during the years of the maestro. And it's been that way when Bernanke came on board, and then also when Yellen came on board. And now we have the new Fed chair, Jerome Powell, who, you know, in many ways has had a rough 2018. It's almost as though, in some of the ways he said things and how he said things caused an enormous amount of volatility here in the very last quarter, especially beginning with October and then ending in December.
Well, right, Carlos. And that's, we do see these signs. And let me just, before I forget, let me just mention something here, because we've been stressing it. By the way, folks, remember, if you're listening to this podcast, what you want to do is also check out the blog posts that we've been putting up at the website. So you go to laramurphy.com. Again, that's LARA-murphy.com. And you've got a lot of blog posts up there with some financial information. Also, while I'm pushing stuff, it's a relatively new feature. I don't know if I've mentioned it recently here, but the interviews from the LMR, the Laura Murphy Report, so that's the subscription-based monthly publication. But the interviews, we decided we're going to just give those away to the world as one of our contributions to humanity. So there you can see the archive of the growing number of interviews we're making available since we made that decision. So at the main website, look at, there's a, you know, little button for interviews at the top. You click that and you can see all the interviews we've done since we made that switch. But what I want to focus on right now here is the Fed has been tightening, and there's a subtlety involved. So at the end of 2015, literally down to the month, 7 years after, you know, the Fed had hit 0% interest rates in terms of its target for the federal funds rate, they started hiking again. Okay, so that started happening again in December of 2015 is when the Fed finally moved away from having basically 0% interest rates and started raising rates. And I think a lot of people were looking around and saying, oh, so now that the Fed's tightening, you know, is the end near? And then it wasn't happening, and no big deal. But the subtlety involved is their balance sheet was held constant from that point forward still. So the balance sheet, actually that so-called QE3 was wrapped up, the so-called taper ended in the fall of 2014. Late 2014 is when the Fed's balance sheet finally stabilized. And so at that point, they had stopped adding net assets to their balance sheet. And then as stuff matured, they would just roll it over. Okay, so from late 2014 forward for several years there, the Fed's total assets in terms of the dollar value was constant, even though at some point, like I say, at the end of 2015, they started raising the target for the federal funds rate. So now you might wonder, how is that possible? How could the Fed have been raising rates without selling off assets? You know, isn't that the standard textbook move? That's how the Fed controls interest rates. And the answer is they were, remember, they instituted this thing about paying interest on reserves. So I won't go into that whole discussion here. I had an LMR article on that recently. But the idea, again, being that the Fed was paying banks to keep their reserves parked at the Fed. So this is a new policy that the Fed implemented in October of 2008, right? Right after the financial crisis hit in September, the Fed comes in with this new policy and begins paying interest on the reserves that commercial banks keep parked at the Fed. That's guaranteed money to the commercial banks, right? You've got money on deposit with the Federal Reserve. It can create money electronically, legally speaking. So there's no way the Fed's not going to be good for that. And so the commercial bank would never make a loan to anybody else for less than what the Fed is paying. So that was setting a floor on short-term rates by the Fed adjusting the interest rate that it itself would pay to banks to keep the reserves parked with the Fed. So that's what the Fed started doing at the end of 2015, was the Fed began raising the rate that it itself paid to commercial banks to keep their reserves parked with the Fed. And so that, of course, just percolated throughout the economy and raised interest rates accordingly by, you know, boosting up that floor of the so-called safest rate. But this Fed was, again, to repeat, at that point was not selling off assets. And so it wasn't sucking money out of the system. It was basically just paying banks to keep the money bottled up, if that's the way you want to think about it. However, in late 2017, for sure, I'm just looking at the chart here. Certainly you see it by early 2018, the Fed's balance sheet actually did start shrinking significantly. Okay. And such that up to, you know, the latest figures I'm looking at here, just eyeballing it, they've sold off more than $400 billion worth of assets. Okay. So, and of course, the Fed still is periodically raising interest rates. But my point is, it was not until 2018 that the Federal Reserve actually, as part of its overall tightening or returning to normalcy, if that's the way you want to think of it, it was not until 2018 that the Fed began letting, as its assets matured and they were effectively sucking reserves out of the financial sector, that the Fed would just let that happen as opposed to rolling them over and re-injecting the reserves back into the system. So there's a very legitimate sense in which the Fed's tightening in 2018, the beginning of 2018 going forward up to this point, has actually been sucking money out of the financial sector, whereas before it wasn't. And so it's not surprising that the real pain seems to have been coming in this year, well, last year, because now we're in early 2019, that, you know, that's not surprising that there was a qualitative difference in the way the Fed was tightening that we hadn't seen before that. So, and I'll let you comment on that, Carlos, because I know you mentioned that too in your article, the fact that, you know, the Fed's assets have shrunk significantly in 2018.
Well, the main thing I wanted to interject, Bob, because I think that, you know, this could be somewhat confusing to a lot of our listeners. I mean, some of them that really understand what's going on here wouldn't be. But for example, in a sense, can we not say that liquidity is coming out of the economy? And when you say that that when Bernanke was doing QE1, QE2, and QE3, that, you know, he was buying quite a bit of bonds on a monthly basis, I think up to $85 billion a month, and that we've written about and talked about this before, that he was deliberately doing that and inflating assets, what he referred to as creating a wealth effect, you know, coming out of the 2008 financial crisis, obviously we were in a recession, and by increasing the prices of assets, particularly in real estate and in the stock market, you know, it gives a wealth effect. So it was a deliberate action on the part of Bernanke. But now, as the Fed has started to shed, you know, a lot of these assets off its balance sheet, as you say, it's sucking money out of the economy, liquidity out of the economy. And so the price of assets have to fall because of it. And so now, then you mentioned that in order to keep the banks, you know, holding on to some of those excess reserves and not letting them out, that the Fed is paying the commercial banks. Am I wrong to say there was something like $38 billion in 2017? I don't know what the actual number was. It's a significant amount of money. So a listener might be thinking, well, how does all that create the kind of volatility that we've been seeing here? Why is this happening? It would be the answer we've got to give our listeners. You know, why are they having to suck the money out of the economy? Why must they persist on doing that? You know, and why are they, you know, having to continue to pay money to commercial banks not to let that money get out into the economy? And is it necessary to keep increasing the interest rates? Where is the real pressure the Fed is feeling for having to continue to suck out the liquidity out of the economy from where it had been up to $4.5 trillion? They're going to try to bring it down to $2 trillion over the course of the next 5 years, and they keep doing that. And as you said, now we're down $400 billion, and the effects are being felt. And then in addition to that, the interest rates are rising. And so the markets are trying to say, stop raising the interest rates. Why are you raising them, you know? And so I think that's where the confusion has been with the marketplace. They've just haven't been able to figure out Powell. And even Trump, you know, chewed him out and was looking for ways to fire him. So what I noticed more than anything, Bob, was that when he made his speech in Atlanta, as early part of January, it was almost
like—
Are
you talking about Powell or Trump?
Powell.
Okay.
When he made that appearance in Atlanta, it was almost like a different Powell. In other words, he actually had notes in the video clip I saw. He had notes on his lap, and he was very careful about what he was saying. You know, he was talking to everyone in terms of, you know, yeah, I'm paying much closer attention to the sensitivity of the markets. And we're going to keep watching this very, very carefully. And obviously, he's saying all that because December was horrible in the markets. And so he has spooked them, in other words. He spooked the markets, and now he's being extremely cautious, and he's watching how he says things, and he's trying to be sensitive to what's going on. And he said, we will make the necessary adjustments, almost as though he's saying, I may not increase the interest rates anymore. And he went as far as to state that if he had to pull back on the unwind of the balance sheet, he would do that. Mm-hmm. So the question I would ask you, Bob, as an economist, for the sake of our listeners, can he actually do that? Or does he have to stay on course? That would be the question.
Yes, and that's great stuff. So I am going to try to answer that, but to give more context to people. So you're right. The real question would be, well, why couldn't the Fed just have kept doing what they were doing? You know, they can make interest rates whatever they want with this tool of interest on reserves. So why don't they just do that? And if you guys are saying that it's the act of, you know, sucking money out of the system by selling off Fed assets and destroying reserves effectively, that's really where you saw the markets getting crushed. Well, why does the Fed need to do that? Why can't they just, you know, whatever the interest rate they think it needs to be, go ahead and adjust the interest they pay on reserves for that and just keep the balance sheet as it is? And I think part of the reason is it was as they raised interest rates, that was going to get more and more expensive. So, for example, you're right, Carlos. I'm looking here at the headlines. apparently the Fed paid the banks $38.5 billion in interest on reserves in 2018. And that was up from the previous year. So what's happening is it originally, when the Fed started paying interest on reserves in October of 2008, at that point, it was something like 0.25% that they were paying. Okay, so it was a real little pittance. And so even though there were a lot of reserves they were injecting into the system, well, you multiply by 0.25%. It's not a huge number. Whereas as the number, you know, goes up to 2.2, 2.4, you know, as they keep raising that floor, which they've been doing, well, now you're multiplying the trillion plus in reserves that, you know, the banks have parked with the Fed times 2.4%. Well, that's a much bigger number than when it was 0.25%. And so that's the problem, whereas interest rates started returning back to more historical norms. By the way, interest rates are still very low compared to, you know, the norm, even just before the recession hit, let alone, you know, back in the 70s and 80s. But the point is that was going to get more and more expensive for them to do that. And there's a sense in which the taxpayers are the ones funding that. And this is why, because the way the Fed works, they go, they create money out of thin air. They buy a bunch of assets. Those assets yield an income. And so the Fed, you know, in terms of the accounting, is earning an income every year or whatever. And they have their bills, you know, they got to pay for the electricity. They pay, you know, the economists on staff, whatever. And they also owe money to the banks that literally legally own the Fed. It's this, a lot of people can't believe this is the situation. It'd be sort of like if the pharmaceutical companies own the FDA. So I understand why this freaks people out, but go look it up. It's on Wikipedia. It's even on the Federal Reserve's main website. You know, this isn't nutty stuff that, in case people don't realize that, yeah, the banks themselves, the private sector banks, own the Federal Reserve in terms of owning shares. Of course, it's highly regulated and all that stuff. And so they get dividend payments from the Fed because they're the shareholders. But that's a fixed amount. It's not like they just, you know, they're not the residual claimants. They get their amount, and then whatever's left over, that gets remitted to the Treasury. So the idea is if the Fed's expenses go up because they're giving more money to the banks in the form of interest on reserve payments, which happened to be $38.5 billion in the year 2018, well, that's $38.5 billion less out of the Fed's earnings that they can hand over to the Treasury. So that's the sense in which, if you want, you know, holding everything else equal, the federal budget deficit would have been $38.5 billion lower had the Fed not had this program in place in 2018. Okay, so that's the idea. And so the problem is if the Fed kept its existing balance sheet in force so that the total amount of reserves were the same and the banks kept them parked at the Fed, as the Fed keeps raising the interest on reserves rate that it pays in order to bring that floor up for its, you know, monetary policy, interest rate targets, and so forth, it would just get more and more expensive to do that. And you could even imagine ultimately, like if things moved around, it's possible the Fed would owe the banks more money than the Fed had income that year. I mean, that would be an issue too. And so I think that's part of what's going on here, Carlos, is they realized we can't just keep raising the floor through this mechanism of bumping up the rate that we ourselves pay to the banks while having the total outstanding amount of reserves be this gigantic number. We got to start selling off assets to suck reserves out of the system so that as we're raising the rate that we pay, the base that rate's applied to shrinks so that, you know, multiply the two together, that number doesn't just keep rising higher and higher. So I think that's part of what's going on. Let me also just mention, Carlos, that you're right, that they weren't making any bones about it. And this had not been on my radar. I don't know if I saw this when it happened, but apparently in August of 2016, I'm looking at a Market Watch article that Janet Yellen explicitly said that was why they weren't selling off assets and instead were just focusing on tightening via the interest rate, you know, rate they pay on excess reserves or reserves in general. And so I'm reading from this Market Watch article, and it says on Friday, so that this is in summer of 2016, Yellen said, "Our ability to predict the effects of changes in the balance sheet on the economy is less than that associated with changes in the federal funds rate." Okay, so she's saying the reason we're going to tighten by raising the federal funds rate rather than selling off assets and shrinking the Fed's balance sheet is that we're less able to predict the impact on the economy from selling off assets. And then, so this is back to the, I'm reading from this MarketWatch article. If assets were sold too slowly, that could cause, quote, excessive inflationary pressures, Yellen said. But, quote, financial markets and the economy could potentially be destabilized if assets were sold too aggressively. And then she explicitly cited the 2013 taper tantrum. So I'm not quoting Yellen here. I'm reading this article, a bond market reaction that sent yields higher by as much as a full percentage point after then Chairman Ben Bernanke said that monetary policy would eventually go back to normal. Okay, so they're referring in 2013 in May, that's when Bernanke let slip that we're going to start tapering, that we're going to slow the monthly purchases that were then enforced, which people call QE3, like Carl said, the $85 billion. Tapering meant we're going to start shrinking that over time so that the Fed's slowing the rate at which it was adding to its balance sheet. And so when Bernanke announced that and made it, you know, led markets to believe, oh, we're going to start doing that later in 2013, all of a sudden, bond yields jumped even a full percentage point. And they call that the taper tantrum, that the markets were having a temper tantrum over, you know, this these announcement regarding the taper of QE3. And so Yellen in 2016 was saying, oh, yeah, remember, you see the effect that happened, you know, back then, remember the impact Bernanke's statement. So that's why we, when we're tightening now, are going to raise interest rates, not sell off assets. So in any event, that was just my long way of saying Carlson and I are not being, you know, we're not reading between the lines here. They are explicitly saying part of the reason we're doing Fed policy this way is to not crash the markets. So, you know, this isn't some kind of conspiratorial theory to say what they're doing is blowing up asset bubbles. You know, they're not using the term bubble, but I mean, they're explicitly admitting that Fed policy was designed to push up markets, like Carl said, the wealth effect. And then as they're unwinding, they're explicitly saying, oh, we're doing it in a way to not bring stocks down. So it's not weird on our part to say, as they get boxed into a corner, as the Fed has to tighten and suck reserves out, the stock market is in serious jeopardy.
Yeah, and I'm glad you use that term, you know, the box that they're in, because, you know, all along we've been saying that everything they've done, all they've done basically is painted themselves into a corner. It's very difficult for them to get out of this thing. And when you're referring to that taper tantrum, I remember reading an article somewhere or even maybe hearing it from Yellen herself talking about that unloading assets was not the way to go based on what had happened when that taper tantrum occurred. So, in other words, as they were buying assets in those large quantities during QE1, 2, and 3, you know, they were deliberately increasing the price of assets, particularly in the stock market and also then later in real estate. So they were deliberately doing that. And of course, the MarketWatch article that you sent me recently, Bob, is the one that I really thoroughly enjoyed reading. I really appreciated that particular one because it was talking about some transcripts of the Federal Reserve FOMC meeting, which was having, he wasn't the chair then, he was just a member of the committee, Jerome Powell, basically telling Bernanke, we got to jump ship here. We got to quit doing this QE1, 2, and 3 thing. And it was in the middle of QE3 that he said that. So we've got to jump. And when we quote what the article actually said, he went on to say, you know, the only question is, to which roof are we going to jump? And across which alley? So there is no risk-free path. This is the best path, and I'm happy that we've landed on it. I'm not concerned about a little volatility, but I have to say I am concerned that there may be more than that here. Now, Bernanke, in that same article, you know, responded to Powell and assured him there would most definitely be volatility in the markets if he stopped buying assets. But nevertheless, I mean, he did take Powell's advice, and that's when he made that public announcement that he was going to stop buying assets. And of course, the markets went haywire. And so that's why they refer to it as the taper tantrum. But what I am seeing that you're answering here, I think for the listeners, I think it's very, very important, is that the fact that you still have a lot of excess reserves in, you know, with the commercial banks involved, and that the Fed is having to pay to keep those excess reserves in place, sort of bottled up, as you say, so it doesn't leak out into the economy. Something that we were very afraid of way back during the 2008 financial crisis and what Bernanke was doing then, we thought it would might even cause hyperinflation. So this is how they bottled it up, by paying the banks not to lend that money out. I think that's very, very key to the understanding of all this. But now, starting out with Yellen trying to do it all by not selling off assets and only increasing interest rates was the way it started. And then it started with actually shedding those assets off the balance sheet. And they've been going at about, you know, 20 to 30 billion a clip ever since 2017, when I think the program started. And as you said, now we're down to 400 billion. And so the combination of those rising interest rates and the shedding off the balance sheet is really what's causing assets to really come down and cause the volatility that's going on. Now, again, I'm doing the same thing you're doing, Bob. I'm going around and around trying to explain this one area, but I do see it as an area that creates a lot of concern for the Federal Reserve on how to make all this happen without crashing the market.
Well, yeah, that's exactly right, Carl. I think you've isolated the issues. And what's funny about, and we'll link to those Market Watch articles too, folks, at the show notes page. Again, this is episode 66 if you want to look this stuff up in the archives. What's funny, Carlos, is do you think people realize that the people making these decisions about Federal Reserve policy were thinking of it as, you know, when Powell, because again, folks, Powell was on the FOMC at the time before he became the Fed chair, that when Powell wants to come up with a metaphor to explain to Bernanke what they're doing, he's thinking, okay, it's like we're on the roof of a really tall building and we're going to jump across an alley to another roof. And it's just a question of which way are we going? That's certainly not the message that was being conveyed to the public, that that's the way they're thinking about it. I mean, that's kind of alarming. And also, too, people just take it for granted, but these Fed minutes are released on a 5-year delay.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's not exactly transparent. I mean, imagine if you were the shareholder of a company and they would give you, you know, the report telling you the profitability and here's what happened 5 years ago.
Yeah. So you're getting an idea of how they talk to each other behind closed doors. And it sounded comical, you know, in the way that you were describing it just then. But that's the way they were talking to each other. And I thought, well, don't they know they're being transcribed? You know, this conversation is being documented. But then I thought about Nixon. You know, Nixon would record everything he said. And of course, he would say all kinds of things too that later came out. So I don't know. It's not the way they talk to the public. And this is one of the things I've noticed is that when Powell first took over, I kind of like Powell's style. I mean, I seemed to be able to read him better than I could Yellen, and definitely better than Bernanke. Powell to me struck me as seemed more at ease over what he was doing and seemed to explain things better. But as the year progressed, I mean, it was getting hard to understand what he was doing, and I think it was having the same trouble with the, you know, market watchers, you know, and that's what was causing all the panic in the marketplace, going up and down. It was all based on what he was going to say next about rates. So yeah, to just agree with what you just said there. The way they were talking in 2013 behind closed doors is not at all the way they talk to the public.
Not at all. And and again, this is the Fed's supposed to be this independent transparent thing and, you know, oh, thank goodness we got that. And, you know, who imagine how the people of the Treasury Department speak with who they're not being transcribed, you know, that kind of thing. So, well, we're probably over time at this point, so we'll wrap it up there. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We hope that shed some light on what's going on with the Federal Reserve and its officials who are all too human. Remember, if you want to get more details like this, you need to subscribe to the Laura Murphy Report. The information there, just go to the website and you can see some free samples. And like I say, the interviews now are going to continue to be posted going forward. That's at lauramurphy.com, LARA-murphy.com. And we will see you next time.
You've just finished another episode of the Laura Murphy Show. Be sure to share this podcast with your friends and colleagues to do your part in building the 10%.
The Laura Murphy Show is provided with the understanding that the staff and contributors of LauraMurphy.com are not herein engaged in rendering legal, accounting, tax, or investment advice. On such matters, please consult your own professional tax, legal, or financial advisor.